Ungalaklik Mulgarunga, Ayugarunga, Abaka Dlaluk, Lupanyuk, Kasaktak, Angayukak, Dag, Lusitatkun, Kutkuk, Herdman, Angayukak, Keturaka, Keturuk, Lutalaluk, Benirak, Kanigluk, Nukakliga, Inuashurak. Good morning. It's so nice to be with all of you. I am learning my language, so I apologize for any mispronunciations. What I said was, I'm from Yunlaklit, Ungalaklik, Ayugarunga, I am Ayu, after my great-grandma, my grandma's mom. My grandparents are Stanton and Irene Ketchtag. My parents are Doug and Vernita Herdman, and I have four children. Gudulchuk, David is 14. Dalaluk, Joseph is 10. My only bunik, my only daughter, Kanigluk, Isabella, just turned 7 today. And my youngest son, Inuatluruk, Rocco, is 4. I wanted to say first how humbled and honored I am to be here with all of you. When I was invited to come and share thoughts with you, my first response was, oh no, there are so many better people. There are so many other people who know more, who can share more. And really just having that moment of just feeling very humbled with the opportunity, especially given my grandparents' connection to Quirk. They really, really loved the organization. My grandpa Stanton was an original board member, and he served for many years. In fact, he had been named the honorary chair for life, which I just thought was so awesome. And he really gave a lot of his heart and his love to the work that Kowarik does. And I know that he would be so proud of what you continue to do for our people and the ways that you use your leadership for our region to put our people, our knowledge at the center. That's the strength that we have, is our culture, our knowledge, and our traditions. And I know that they would be so proud. And so for me, it's very humbling to get to speak to all of you. You guys are so beautiful. Oh my goodness, just looking at all of you, really, really humbling and such an honor to be here with you. I wanted to say, before sharing thoughts, how much I appreciate what you do for our communities. To be in a position of leadership, helping to guide our communities, our people, through sometimes some of the most difficult times, and also some of the most beautiful times, is such an honor. And so I just wanted to express appreciation to you for the things that you do for our people and for our communities. You're so important. And the love that you have and that you share through your work, it makes a difference every day. So I just wanted to express that at the very beginning, my gratitude to each of you. I had an opportunity recently to spend time with a good friend of mine, with a group of people. His name is Wilson Justin. I imagine many folks in here know him. He's Atna from the Chistochina area. And one of the things that he had shared was that he appreciated as he was growing into eldership. I don't know that he considers himself an elder just yet. That one of the things that he appreciates the most is that he no longer questions, why am I here? Why am I the one who's given this opportunity? Why am I invited to this? There are other people, like I just expressed to you, there are other people that would speak to this better. So-and-so needs to be in the room. And he was talking about how growing into his eldership, one of the things that he appreciated the most was that has quieted down for him, that he now carries kind of a peace that he doesn't need to know why him. That he was placed there for a reason. And if he quiets his mind and really thinks about it, he knows why. He knows why he was called to be in that space and in that time. And in that moment, he knows what he needs to share. And I really appreciated him sharing that, because, you know, I struggle with that too. Why do I have this opportunity? And, you know, when I'm talking to someone, just being in that kind of space. And so that's peace that I aim for, to have that. There's a reason that I was placed here. Because one of the teachings of my grandma, Irene Banyuk, was every single person that was in this room was born at a different time, born in different places in our world. Surely there's a reason that we're all in this room at the same time right now. And having peace with that. And so with that, I just offer some of my own journey. And I pray and I hope that within my story, there's something that can resonate with you in the work that you do, and thinking about your own stories and what's happening in our communities. I've been thinking a lot about a belief that I carry recently. I really believe that the gifts that we've been given, the strengths that we have, don't belong to us. They belong to our community. And the gifts that we have help our community as a collective to be stronger. And most recently, I've been in a place where I've really, really been thinking about my gifts and where I want to place my energy. I'm currently in the middle of treatment for breast cancer. First time saying that in a big group. I finished chemo about a month ago, and actually I have surgery this week. My surgery is on Thursday, so I really was really hoping to spend the entire week with all of you, but I have to go back and get ready for this next stage of my life. I usually don't even share that, honestly, because I don't want the attention to be on me. But I wanted to share it because even though it has been the most challenging time that I've experienced, it has also really provided me with a really blessed opportunity to think about the gifts that I've been given and really think about how I can use that to serve my community, my people. And so it makes me think about a teaching that I know exists in different forms within all of our communities. All of our cultural teachings serve to help us to be strong in different ways. And one that I've been really thinking about recently is our naming ceremonies, the ways that we're named, and what that means to us. A wonderful Tlingit elder, statesman, scholar, Dr. Walter Sobolev, in talking about our names, our native names, he talked about how over the course of your lifetime, your name will carry you. And I've grown up with this. I grew up with my grandparents saying, this is Jory, and, you know, their friends going, oh, okay, and then them saying, this is Ayu. And then they would look at me with fresh eyes, like, oh, Ayu, that's Ayu, right? And so over the course of my life, my name has carried me. When I say that I'm Ayu, those who know my community and my people, they know who I am. They know where I come from. They know my family. And that has carried me. But what Dr. Walter Sobolev talked about is how there comes a point in your life when you will begin to carry your name. And those who come to know that name will associate it with you. And I don't feel that I'm there quite yet. I don't feel that people will think IU and I'm the association that they have, at least not in my own community. But I think about how much responsibility that has. And it helps me to be strong in thinking about how I need to be the best IU that I can be, because I'm only carrying this name for a short time, you know? And so I really appreciate that. Really appreciate that teaching that really grounds me. And I feel honestly like I'm still just at the very baby beginning of understanding what that means for me. But it's exciting to think about. So part of what I've been pondering lately is about IU, my IU that I come from, my grandma's mom, IU, Edna Econ. She was born in 1895. And when I think about what was happening in my community at that time, I really wonder what growing up was like for her. Axel Carlson, the first missionary from the Covenant Church, came to Unalakleet in 1887, just 8 years before my great-grandma, IU, was born. So when she was born, he had been there for 8 years and had started to ground some of the Covenant Church teachings in the community. And as I've been on this journey to understand the context for what my community is facing now, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about the role of the church and the education system and what has happened to our people. And I've spent a lot of time reading the missionaries' journals and the church publications to help me understand, when they came into our community, what were they thinking? Did they come in and love us so much? Were they so enamored with our way that they knew that this was the home that they wanted to be part of? Did they see our knowledge and our culture as ways to help enrich and deepen the understanding of the teachings that they were bringing? These are questions that I have, because the church continues to be very strong in my community. And I have very complicated feelings about that. So in reading through church publications about their mission work in Alaska, I came to know a little bit more about what they were thinking when they came to my community. Carlson came to a people whose homes, hearts, and minds were benighted. They lived in gloomy igloos. Of the true God, their maker, they knew nothing. Neither did they understand much about the value of the riches that his bountiful hand had so freely scattered around them. They had no schools. They could neither read nor write. Savage customs and superstitions prevailed among them, and so-called medicine men ruled over most of them. Through the generosity of white men, whalers, and others, the Eskimos had learned to like and to make intoxicating liquor. Even during his first year in the village, Carlson saw many people that were drunk. This is an excerpt from the Church, Covenant Church's publications about their mission work in Alaska. So when I found out that I was going to be addressing you here, I've never actually been in this building when I've been here in Sitnasauk. I had complicated feelings about it because I'm still trying to work through it. I'm still trying to understand the complexity of the time and the ways that people were thinking and reconciling those things with what we're facing right now in our families and in our communities. So when I think about, again, my namesake, IU, like I said, the church had been within my community for 8 years when she was born. And so I think about her mom and her dad, and I think about the changing time in the way that they were raising Ayu and their family, and how she was raised into childhood and then adulthood and motherhood in this changing time of someone else's view on the right way to be. Because prior to that, in our communities, our people lived perfectly with the land. We had thousands of years of experience that taught us how to be safe, how to be strong, how to be well. We had ceremonies that helped us to grieve in a healthy way, that helped us to celebrate, that helped us to understand the toll that our long, dark, cold winters can have on us. And we had ceremonies that helped us through those times. And when things went bad, we had traditions and ways of handling those so that our community continued to be strong. Our language, which captures knowledge of the land that can't be found anywhere else. So prior to that, our people were living in perfect harmony with our lands. And we were living well with each other. The fact that we are still here today is demonstrative of that. And so to grow up in a time and to become a mother, for Ayu to become a mother in this time of change, I think about the lessons that she had to be teaching my own grandma, Irene, and all of her brothers and her sisters. That she was then in a position where she was having to teach her own children that sanctity and success looks and sounds and lives differently than we do. For you to be successful, you need to learn and speak English. You need to learn and be these other ways. Something that I know also during this period of time is around between 1915 to 1918 is when the church was successful in quelling our songs and our dances and our ceremonies. So the ways that we had developed to be healthy and strong and pass down our teachings and to celebrate with each other had gone silent in this time. My own grandpa, Tlaloc Stanton, next month in November, it will be 100 years since he was born. So my grandpa was born into this silence of our traditions, our songs. And as he grew into his own adulthood and parenthood, I know that my grandparents wanted the very best for their kids, my mom, my aunties, and my uncles, as our people always do. And what they had been told and came to believe was that success for them looked differently than us. And so in many ways, they did not teach how to speak Inupiaq, teaching how to put our foods away, our old stories, because they wanted the best for their kids. I wanted to share with you some writing that my grandma had done. She sent this, I think it was to the Tundra Times, and I believe it was in 1968, roundabouts. Quite prolific, as you can see. I'm not going to read all of it. Her letter to the editor, I'll just read part of it. But for me, it kind of gives a little bit of a window into her motherhood. My parents gave up camping because they want us to go to school. I know it was hard for them to give up the great outdoor living. It's no wonder disease is increasing among our native people. My folks believe in fresh air. They used to take us out squirrel hunting too for parkas in the spring. This too is a diminishing event. Now let me jump to the year 1960s. Even before these years of 1960s, I really regret why I have sent my first four children to boarding schools under Bureau of Indian Affairs. Many of you will think I'm crazy. My family used to be very close before they start to go to these faraway places 9 months out of each year. They would write home and say, "Mom, I want to come home." How many times I read the letter first and cried. They would go each fall just because their friends are going. They're real different people when they come home. They're restless. They say our towns are dead. Nothing to do. They have no more interest in church or Sunday school. In those years, I used to wish from the heart that our high schools were built nearer to our villages so we could at least let them come home on holidays. Our village's attitude today is too much, let Bureau of Indian Affairs do it. So when I think about IU and her teaching of my grandparents, and that she is a parent, and I'm a parent now too, had to teach her own kids that they needed to speak and live differently than her to be successful and to be good. And I think about how much that must have hurt. I can't imagine having to do that with my own children right now, that I have to put away who I am because who I am is not good enough. Because I want the best for them, and I want them to grow up to be healthy and strong, the best that they can be. And it helps me to start to understand some of the context that we live in. A lot of our knowledge and our history is now privileged information. To access it, you have to go to college, or you have to pay to go into a museum in many times, just to have access to our ways. And not all of us have that kind of access. And those of us who do have an opportunity to go to school and we have this experience of starting to understand, even still it's difficult to reconcile what has happened with what it means to us today. I want to share my own experience with you. I shared with you IU thinking about what she was thinking of in her own motherhood and how she had to be with my grandma Irene, and some of my grandma's thinking about having to send her kids away. And then I think about what my parents, what my aunties and my uncles talked about their upbringing. And I think about the relationship between mothers and daughters, specifically because of my experience. I told you I have four children, three boys and one daughter. When I found out that I was pregnant with my daughter, I cried. Because I didn't know if I could be a good mom to a daughter. Because the mother-daughter relationships in my family were so dysfunctional. My mother has given me permission to talk about these things because she knows that it's important and that it's not just our experience. So my mother and I had a very dysfunctional relationship when I was growing up. She was an alcoholic and we didn't connect in many ways. And we handled our disconnect in lots of different ways that weren't healthy for us. And as I grew up and became a mother, I started to find myself very angry with some of the things that I had experienced in my relationship with her growing up. and I wanted to talk to her about it. But in my anger, I wasn't doing it in a good way. And when I approached my mom about it, she shut me down and she left. By this point, they were living out of the state. She left, and we made this decision that we were no longer going to be in each other's lives. I decided my children are better if they don't know her. I'm better if I'm not continuing to be hurt by her. We decided that we were gonna go our separate ways. And you know what? For a while, I thought that I was okay with that. I thought that that was the right decision. And I felt like it didn't bother me. I felt like a relief to be apart from that. And then I traveled down to New Zealand as part of my work, and I had an opportunity to attend a research conference. And there, an Aboriginal woman from Australia was talking about her family's experience. She was talking about how she had her daughter, and then she had a granddaughter. And when she had her granddaughter, for the first time in her life, she experienced something she had never felt before. She felt love. She felt like she wanted to protect this little girl. She wanted to take care of her, and she felt like she wanted to be affectionate with her. She wanted to be by her. She wanted to teach her. And it took her by surprise because she had never in her life felt that way. Not even with her own daughter. And as a researcher, she wondered why. She wondered, why is it that this feeling is coming to me now? And so she decided to center her research on that. And so she started to peel back these layers of mother-daughter relationships in her own family. Her mother had been part of what they call the stolen generation in Australia. Aboriginal children were taken from their homes at very young ages, and they were sent to work on farms far, far, far away from their families, and they were treated very badly. And her mother and her auntie, who had been taken when they were 2, 3, they escaped when they were early teenagers. They escaped from these farms. And her mother made it to Sydney, where she put herself through nursing school. She became a nurse. She got married. She had her daughter, and life continued on. She knew that this was part of her mom's history, but they had never really talked about it. And she started to understand for the first time that because her mother had been taken away at such a young age, that she hadn't grown up with the affection and love and protection of her mother. And because she didn't grow up with that, when she became a mother, she did not do that with her daughter. And so the researcher knew in her own upbringing that, you know, she hadn't been raised with affection, her mother hadn't told her that she loved her, any of those kinds of things. There was this very distant relationship. And that's just normal, right? When you grow up in these kinds of spaces, that's your normal and you don't really think about it. And so when she became a mother, she did the same thing with her daughter. But it wasn't until her granddaughter was born that she felt this love and realized where that disconnect came from, that it came from her mother being taken away, that she hadn't grown up with knowing how to be an Aboriginal mother in the ways that they knew. If this story sounds familiar for some of you, her mother was the one who wrote the book Rabbit Proof Fence, which then became a movie. So they've talked about what that experience was like. So I'm sitting here in New Zealand, halfway across the world. It's in July, which is their winter. I'm in a darkened auditorium, and there's this researcher standing up just like I am right now, and she's talking about her experience. And for the first time, I understood what had happened between my mother and I. I understood that her going to boarding school her experiences of disconnect from our culture had fed into how she parented me. It was the first time that I realized what has happened to us, really realized what has happened to us, and how it affects us even today. And within that, starting to understand how that shows up in my mothering, how I am with my kids. So when I landed back in Los Angeles, coming back from New Zealand, it happened to be my mom's birthday, and I called her, and we cried together. And that was the beginning of us understanding why it has been so hard between us, and that was the beginning of us trying to mend that and heal that in our family. I share this because I know that my experience is not unique, and that these things helped me to understand how the ripple effects travels through the generations and how we internalize these things even today. In Yun Lakleet, I shared with you that it was around 1915 that our community celebrated our last feast and our singing and our dancing. That was the last time that we did that back home. And I don't want to keep flipping through these papers, but it's within that same publication, church publication, that I shared with you before, and it's corroborated with our own elders sharing that with us last summer. And so I grew up my whole life knowing that our songs and our dances were gone. And I grew up really feeling that loss. When I would hear our drums beating, I would feel like my heartbeat would match. And I would feel like I wanted to express myself through our songs and our dances, but I would feel mute. Like I didn't have the words, I didn't have the way to do it. So imagine my surprise. Last year, about a year and a half ago, Yayuk was with us. We, at First Alaskans Institute, were hosting an intergenerational succession planning, Indigenous succession planning think tank. We were talking about what is the knowledge within our communities and our traditions where we have passed leadership down in our good ways that can inform the ways that we do it as an organization better. And we had people from all over the state. We had elders and we had youth. And one of our elders from Southeast, actually, she asked a question just of the entire group. She said, do you have protocols around your songs and your dances? Like, are there only certain times that you can dance them and only certain families? And I know Yayuk was sharing some of her knowledge around what happens within her community, and other people were answering. And there was a young man from Caltag who was there, Tristan Madras. Some of you may know him. He's been identified as his community as the next chief, and he's a young man. He just graduated high school last year. And his community sees him as a culture bearer because he was raised by his grandpa with their teachings and with their songs and with their knowledge. And if you ever get a chance to hear him, it's kind of a trip because he's a young man, but he sounds like an elder when he talks. And so he was with us. And so he was talking about, in Caltech, their protocols around the stick dance. And he was talking about this is when we do it, how we do it. And then he was talking about their mask dances. And he was saying, you know, our mask dances, we do it around New Year's time. We really focus on it being very upbeat because it's a time to bring in the new year in a good way. And he said, and all of our mask dances came to us from Yun Lakleet. And then he kept talking. And I sat there and I felt that feeling. You ever watch movies where it's still focused on the person, but it's like the background goes zooming behind them? I totally had that moment. I was sitting there and I felt like everything around me changed. And so at lunchtime, I went to go sit by him. And Yayuk joined us too. And I said, "Tristan, you said that your songs and your dances came from Umlakleet. How can that be possible? I've been told my whole life that our songs and our dances are gone." And he just nodded in his elder youth way. And he said, "I know." He said, "It was about 100 years ago. Your community recognized that your missionaries were banning your songs and your dances. And you sent 3 of your women to Kel-Tag to be married. And you told them, take our songs with you and protect them. And that for 30 years after that, people from our community would dog sled over to Kel-Tag at New Year's time to hear our songs and our dances. And they sing them and they dance them to this day." And I have to tell you, it's a trip, because we're in a Inupiaq village, right, with Yupik, and they're Koyukon. And so I've been able to hear snippets of them singing and dancing our songs, and it's Athabaskanized Inupiaq with the flavor of Yupik. And it just blew me away to find out that our songs were living somewhere else. And so I connected with him the next day and I said, "Tristan, do you think your people might be willing to share the songs back with us?" And he said, I can't say. I think you should talk to our traditional chief, Mary Rose Agnes." And I said, "Okay, can I get her number?" So I called our tribe's president, Jacob Ivanov, and I let him know what I had just learned the day before. And I asked him, because I don't live in Unalakleet, I live in Anchorage, and I would never want to do anything on behalf of my community that isn't what we really want. And I needed to know if I was the only person who felt this way, who felt this excitement, who wanted to bring our songs and our dances back. And he was excited too, and he said, "Yeah, call her, find out what we can do." So I called her, and I don't know if any of you know her. She's feisty. She's a feisty elder, just awesome. And when I was talking with her, at first she was like, I don't know what you're talking about. That doesn't sound familiar to me. No, I don't know. I'm not sure. And so I kept talking and telling her about how when I'm home, I can feel the loss of our songs and our dances, and how important I feel it would be to bring healing to our community, to be able to express ourselves in this way again. And she said, "Oh, this is starting to sound familiar. Someone sent us a letter from Unalakleet. Someone sent us a letter a while back demanding that we give your songs back." "Is that what you're talking about?" And I said, "I can't speak on behalf of my people or my community, but I can tell you how much it meant to me. As an Inupiaq woman from Unalakleet, how much it meant to me to find out that our songs and our dances are alive. And I can't imagine our community ever wanting to take away from others what has been taken away from us. And I know that it's an important part of the way that you celebrate your culture now. I can't imagine our community ever wanting to take that away. But if you might be willing to share the songs back with us so that we can begin singing and dancing our songs again, I know how healing that would be for our people. And she was quiet for a long time, so long that I almost thought that we had lost the connection. And then she said, okay, let's do it. So fast forward this time, last year. In fact, it might have been even this week, last year. I think it was this week, last year. I got to travel with members of our tribal council over to Caltech, and their Nulato chief traveled down. And we spent a full day together talking about how they sing and dance our songs. And over the course of a full day, by the end of it, they agreed to give our songs back officially. And they committed to coming to our community to teach the songs and the dances, because they're singing and dancing them, but they don't know what the words mean. And the dialect is Unalaq. So it has the Yupik roots. And so they don't know the meanings of a lot of these songs. And so it'll take more work to actually understand what these are. But they've committed to coming to our community. No, I do want to find that one excerpt. Sorry, my nose is running. Okay, right here. Oh, Poyana. Perfect timing. Okay. Evil dies hard is an old saying, and the Alaska missionaries have found it so. This is the Covenant Church publication about their mission work in Unalaklik. One of the old evils that repeatedly threatened to ruin the work of the missionaries was the Eskimo feasts and the dances with all that went with them. In 1915, Gustafsson could report that, for the first time in their history, the Unalaklik natives had not held their yearly big feast and dance. Gustafsson had worked hard to make the natives understand that those dances and feasts brought much evil with them. So here we are, 102 years later, and we're on the precipice of what it can look like to reclaim our knowledge, our traditions, our ceremonies. And within my own community, we're talking about what does it look like to bring these things back? Because in my community, most of our celebrations are secular. We celebrate 4th of July, Christmas, Jamboree. We don't get to celebrate who we are distinctly as Inupiaq and Yupik people as a community. So we have to relearn what that looks like. And for those of us who don't have that knowledge of our language, of our traditions, that can bring a lot of shame and embarrassment. But what I say to you, that I hope all of our people can feel and know, is that that shame, that guilt, doesn't belong to us. It belongs to those who took it from us. And these feelings that we have should no longer have the power over us to not reclaim them. Just some thoughts that I have briefly about the work that I get to do in our communities. Things that I see, and part of why I'm so excited about this summit, having so many different people together from all over our beautiful, diverse region, We have so much diversity in knowledge and culture and practice. That's such a strength that we have. It makes us distinct from any other part in the state, the people who are in our region. And so some of the things that I see and wish for and dream for in our communities is to be able to, as people, let go of the things that don't serve us. Let go of the ways that have been imposed on us that stifle our beauty as Indigenous people of Alaska, our knowledge. Our people recognized how important it was to create space for men and women, that we would have these spaces and times and places to deliberate in the Kariki, Kozuki, our men's house, women's house. It looked different in different communities. But we recognized the importance of our people coming together to really talk about what's happening in our communities, what's good, what's hurting, what do we need to do to address these things. Through oral through oral tradition, we know that in my own community, the missionaries stomped in four of our kuzkis, our places to deliberate as a community. And something that I see now in my own community and others is that we have so many resources in organizations that are doing really great work. They're doing important work for our community, but it's very siloed within organizations and within entities with mission statements that's like wholly contained by that organization. And that's the way that we've been taught, right? It's a very Western way of compartmentalizing leadership. The problem with that is that it doesn't create the space for us to come together as a community, to make decisions as a community about what it is that we want to see. What's our vision for Ungalakleek far beyond our time here? That's what we were taught, is to be thinking about how your decisions will affect generations beyond our time here. The way that Western organizations are set up with their structure, strategic plans are perpetually temporary. Strategic plans attempt to capture within a period of time the things that you'll do. And there's beautiful things in our strategic plans and in our missions and in our visions. But if we're not connecting with each other and we're not utilizing all of the resources that are in our community to achieve the vision that we want to see, we're missing an opportunity. And we're going to be spinning our wheels in our organizations. And we may be working against ourselves without even knowing it. What does it look like if we, as people, as tribal members, as community members, if we look at the resources in our community as collective resources, if we come together as people first and we say, this is the vision. I love the vision, Melanie, that you shared. Our people, our tribes and our peoples are thriving. That should be all of our visions, right? If our vision is this for our community, how can the city help advance that? What is it that the tribe can do? How about the village corporation? What about the school district? All of these are resources that are at our disposal as a community. How are we activating them together so that we're moving in the same direction together instead of assuming that we are because we have the best interests at heart? we can be more effective if we come together and we do decision-making together as a community. There's nothing that's stopping us from reinstating our karigi. There's no reason that we couldn't, in that room, right now, decide to have a men's house. There's nothing stopping us from making these decisions for our community and doing what we know is right and reconnecting with our ways. That can start right now. And perpetuating our ways of life, making sure that our ways of life thrive beyond our time here, it can't be funding dependent. We can't say, yeah, we can bring our songs and our dances back, but we need to get a grant first. We can't say, yeah, we should learn how to make the mukluks, but that's being tied up in a federal grant right now. Once that's done, we can figure it out. It's not effective. And we know where that path leads. We know that only getting to practice who we are as Native people in bits and pieces, in spaces, we know where that path leads. We are resourceful people. We are smart people. The more time I have on this earth, the more appreciation I have for our knowledge and our ways of being. A good friend of mine in Caltech, actually, I just loved what he said about our community. He said, our community, we're like the willow. You could cut the willow down, you could cut it back, you could just like cut to try and get rid of it, right? But if there's even a shred of root, it will regrow and thrive, right? And he talks about that's how our community is. When it comes to practicing who we are, in many ways, it has been whittled down, not by our choice, by what has happened, but we can and will regrow, like the willow. So I began by talking about 100 years behind us and really reflecting on how did we come to be where we are right now? And I apologize because some of what I shared was heavy. And some of what I read may cause uncomfortable feelings within you. It's complicated, these feelings that we have about religion, about the education system, these kinds of things. It can be uncomfortable, and so I apologize for that. But I also know how strong we are, and I know that we have inherently an incredible ability to work through the most complicated, complex problems, even within ourselves, and come out stronger. So I began by thinking about 100 years behind us and the great changes that were happening at that time. Now, I would like to challenge you to be thinking 100 years from now, what is it that they will say about us? What will our future ancestors have to say about us in this time that we're living in? We have an opportunity in front of us. What is it that we'll do with it? What makes us distinct? What's the knowledge that we carry that can make Alaska a better place? So with that, I would just like to leave you with that. I would also, if you will indulge me, I would like to sing to you. Full disclosure, I'm not great at singing. This is also something that I don't do, but I think it's part of our healing. I discovered a recording at the UAF library of an elder from our community in the late 60s, Thora Ketchteg. At the time of the interview, she was in her 80s. And she talked about all kinds of things, the history of Yunlaklit, how things used to be, her thoughts about what was happening at the time, late 60s, early 70s. And in the middle of her interview, it's like 18, 19 minutes long, she sang a song. She just called it Dancing Song. And she said her mother wrote it. It's from Yunlaklit. And so as part of my own healing, I have made myself learn it. And I sing it to my kids every night. And you know what? They sing it to me too. Sometimes this is what intergenerational healing looks like, right? Now I'm getting nervous. I told you I was going to sing in front of you, and now I don't want to. Okay. And this will be my closeout. Okay. Dayo ang.